by 6:30, but I have a summit that we'll do at some point toward the end of the class today. I'm going to talk some about the key protections for subjects and research overlapping some of your readings, and then I'm going to give you a case to analyze based on what we talk about in class, and we'll probably have two groups just in the size of this. Maybe we'll have three. From the pillar over, you guys, and you guys. And what I want to do is have a spokesperson in each group who will act as the chair of the, what basically is going to be an IRB, to convey what the group thought about. And since I know you're all eager to volunteer for that role, any volunteers? All right, you. Oh, there's a volunteer. You're kind of on that group there, so you can do that one. That one, and you. All right, so there's three chairs. And you don't have to pass or fail this particular test. It's just to put to use the particular principles. So in your readings, what's the first principle of the Helsinki Code of Ethics governing human subjects research?
Volunteers.
They
have to be volunteering
for the research. Mm-hmm. You're on the right track. Anybody want to amend that? Expand that slightly? The consent of the subject is absolutely essential. It can't be changed right away for reasons we'll talk about in a minute, but this is principle that you have to give your permission before you can be used in research. So research ethics are different from therapeutic ethics. When somebody offers you a treatment, they go through the benefits for you and what the dangers might be, and they need your permission to offer the treatment, as we talked about when we're talking about refusing life-supporting interventions. And the doctor is supposed to deliver that treatment according to the standard of care that prevails in their community, usually, although it might be statewide in some parts of the country. But they have a standard of care requirement. You can't deviate too much from what other doctors do. Notice if all doctors are doing stupid things, it's still okay because you're still on the standard of care, so that's not a protection. But roughly speaking, what your peers think is appropriate if you have cancer or Parkinsonism or the flu is what you should be doing, and you shouldn't get too far off of that. Or if something goes wrong, you could be in big trouble. And that's where malpractice comes from. It's deviations from the standard of care. Is there a standard of care in research? And if there were, it wouldn't be research anymore. We'd know what to do, or we'd have some idea of what the evidence is. So in research, we don't really know what's the best thing to do. So by definition, research either means we don't know what to do, or among the things that we could do, we're not sure which one's the best. That has a fancy name called equipoise, meaning among the options, we're not sure which one would really work. We may have some evidence that each one of them has some value. We may have a little bit of evidence that one is a little better than the other, but not enough to push it over to conviction or being sure, or even sure with a high degree of probability. So options, or just complete uncertainty, characterize what makes something experimental or innovative as opposed to therapeutic. So the ethics of research are very different from the ethics of therapy. Therapy assumes we know what works, so we have some idea that something's going to be pretty good for you and you ought to do it in the way that the field has agreed that it ought to be done. And by the way, it's the same for dentistry and nursing and psychotherapy. The peers agree on what you're supposed to do in the face of X, and then you're supposed to do that. But you still get permission from the person, but that permission is more so that they understand the risk and benefit of the therapeutic intervention. And they can or cannot accept it or decide that they want to have it. on research, we don't know the answer to what's best, right? If you're in research, can you expect or should you expect a benefit? Do you? No.
Yeah.
I mean, you might be lucky and get one. You might be edging toward one as more knowledge gets built up, but you really can't expect benefit in research because we don't know. As soon as you can say, I know that's good for you, then your ethical obligation is to give it. So, I mean, even if it's with some uncertainty, but if you said, you know, 60% of the time this is going to work and help you, it would be hard to withhold it from somebody and say, well, we still have to study this further, and you might be in a study where you didn't get it versus you did get it. So for therapies, there's a duty to provide what the doctor thinks is, or nurse, or whoever thinks it's best. In research, we don't know. And you're not really there to expect a benefit. The more early up in the stages of research you are, even less likely you're going to get a benefit. I'll say something about that in a minute. What makes something research as opposed to goofing around, screwing around, or otherwise mucking around?
There's a hypothesis.
There's a hypothesis. So you have a hypothesis. What else? You're on the right track.
Some type of protocol?
Yeah. You have a hypothesis and a method that you're going to use to answer the hypothesis. So what characterizes research is a question or hypothesis that you're going to try to get an answer to by using what I'll call recognized methods. You mean, actually, you can't just have any method. You can't sort of bring out your Ouija board and say, I'm going to ask it. What you look for in research is standardized methods. And to the extent to which there's a standard of care in the research side, it's more about the methods than it is about the practice. If I did some really weird data collection, you know, I said something like, I'm going to throw everything down the stairs and whatever's at the bottom is going to be true, I could say that, but I had deviated from what people expect me to do in terms of a double-blind trial or a case-control trial or doing a survey of people, you know, standard techniques I might use that seem to have stood the test of time to generate reliable answers. Everybody follow that? So you can innovate and screw around and muck around, and I use those words deliberately without doing research. It's not organized. You don't really have a question to answer. You don't have methods that would answer the question. You just kind of, you know, I wonder if I give you this, what would happen? That's not a hypothesis, and it's not a method. It might be something that somebody tried, but it's technically not research. And in the legal definition of research that we use today, it's any behavior that is intended to create generalizable knowledge using recognized methods. So I mention this again because it is possible to innovate. Surgeon decides, I might try tying this knot differently today, just to see if it holds better or if it's faster for me to do it. It's not maybe innovation, but it's not research. There's no method being used. There's nothing being assessed. It's a case of one, maybe two or three. But if you're going to really start to tie that knot differently every time, you might want to get that into a research protocol, as opposed to just an innovation. There are people who avoid having things become research by continuing to innovate. They don't ask a question, and they never organize things according to a protocol or a method. They're just mucking around.
Would that be considered development?
Could be. Sometimes people say, well, we have funny names like off-label use for a drug, surgical innovation. And you can argue, we're not going to settle it tonight, but you can argue back and forth whether having a certain amount of leeway for people to kind of fool around a little bit is the best way to advance knowledge. I'll say this. The sooner you get things onto research protocols, the better. But it may be too restrictive to say you always have to begin with a hypothesis and a research protocol because that may never let you sort of try or speculate or innovate at all. Usually what happens in real-world research is somebody says, let's say more in the surgical or nursing side, I'm going to try to do this thing or rehab and see if it helps. And if it looks like it's helping a little bit, then pretty quickly you put it into a study. But it's not, we're going to study this from the get-go. You usually wait to see if there's something involved that might be beneficial or looks like it's promising. You don't have that with drugs, because normally we're starting drugs where? Who gets the first drugs? Animals. So that's the evidence that makes things look promising there. Sometimes, though, there are places in medicine or healthcare where you do see innovation on humans, and sometimes it's for reasons that you're not doing it in animals, or you couldn't do it in animals, other sort of oddball reasons. I'm not sure what innovation and rehabilitation technologies look like in mice anyway, if you can move their little arms and legs around a little bit. So, some things are kind of in people first, but you quickly, if you're going to be ethical about it, want to get it into a research protocol. Otherwise, you're starting to subject people to risk, you're not learning anything, and you're starting to treat it as a therapy as opposed to something you really don't know the answer to yet. So the push morally is to get innovation over toward organized research as fast as you can. So, therapy isn't research. The ethics of therapy are different from research. One protection that you as a patient have is standard of care in therapy. In research, nobody knows what to do, really. Technically. So you don't have the same protection that you're going to get exposed to something that we kind of know or believe we know what's the standard thing to do. You're going to get something nobody is sure of what's the best thing to do. So you're more vulnerable as a research subject than you are as a patient. So subjects are a little more at risk than they are when they're patients. You don't hear people talk too much in research about trying to be beneficent or trying to do good. What they're trying to do is learn. It's a different objective. And they have to use people, to some extent, use them to get answers to questions. Now, obviously, you hope that in doing research, particularly if it looked good in animals, that it might be useful in people. But we also know that the failure rate of what looks good in animals moving through people is high. I mean, really high. What's the best thing for you to be if you have cancer in America today? A mouse. Because we got a lot of cures for mice. They don't generalize up to people. Mice are interesting models. They're not fully reliable to generalize from to people. The failure rate from somebody seeing something early on in animals to a drug that gets FDA approval is about 99%. So it's pretty high. Research is hard, doesn't work very well, slow, long process. It's part of the reason you'll hear pharmaceutical companies always complaining that it takes them a lot of money to do the research to get from the bench to the pharmacy. There's a huge failure rate, and they have to pay for all that, even though they may get blockbuster drugs or very successful ones. There's still a big number that don't pan out, and they just have to write off that stuff as dead-end kind of research. All right, so that's research versus therapy. That's the definition of research. And we said to be a subject, you have to give permission, but you need two other kinds of protections that we're going to talk about tonight. One is peer review. I'm going to explain how that came about, but you might think of peer review, meaning review by committee or IRB or ethics committee, is standing in for the standard of care. That's what it's doing. It's replacing what normally would be on the therapy side in terms of having your peers say, well, you did something as a back surgeon that's really weird. You put these screws in a different angle. You put this device in upside down because you just thought it might work that way, but that's way outside the standard of care, so if something goes wrong, you're in trouble. In experimentation, we don't really know what's the right way to put the thing in or what's the right way to administer the drug, so it's hard to say there's a standard of care, but what replaces that is peer review. people looking over your shoulder and saying, that hypothesis is reasonable, this method is reasonable, I think you could get an answer to that question. And the third protection is managing conflict of interest. I'm going to talk about each one of these. Consent, voluntary consent to be a subject. You don't have to be a subject. Somebody doing peer review and somebody trying to manage conflict of interest so that if I make the little machine or make the device and I say, I think this would be great for you to try it and it's really what you need, but I don't tell you that there are three other devices that are less invasive because I happen to be the one making this one and I want it to work, then you need to know that there are some other options. And whether you can trust me to tell you the other options is part of managing conflict of interest in research. So those are the three protections. And there's one other one that's very, very important that I'm not going to talk a lot about, but there's a fourth one or a background one, and that is what I'll call integrity. At the end of the day, if you want to forge consent forms, lie about what you're going to do in reality relative to what you wrote down on paper that you said you were going to do in a study, but you don't do it when you're really out there doing the experiment, it's hard to catch you. Normally, you don't get caught until somebody gets harmed. And then it's kind of late. If you're going to have research ethics at all, you have to have the researcher being the most committed and the most concerned about the ethics of research, because no one is in there to look over their shoulder in the carrying out of the work. There might be a lot of paper moving around and people signing things, but if I choose to be in a clinic and doing a study in a certain way and I don't do what I told everybody I was going to do, how's anybody going to know? So at the end of the day, the biggest requirement is that the researcher themselves have integrity and do what they need to do the way they said they were going to do it. So if you don't have that, we don't really have a big system of research police who come in the lab and say, you know, let's see your subjects, let's see what you're doing, are you doing what it said you were going to do over here? There's an occasional audit, I won't say it never happens, but it's pretty rare. Integrity is really important. And so for those of you who do research, you need to understand at the end of the day, research ethics is not something imposed in. It's something that you have to display. It's not for lawyers or ethicists or outsiders. It's actually something that's at the core of what you have to do as a responsible researcher. Everybody see that? It relies on people having integrity to make the whole thing go. You can write all the rules and stuff that you want, but it's very hard to police them or enforce them in a practical way unless people say, yeah, I'm going to try my best to protect my subjects. All right, so coming back to our old friend informed consent, which is the voluntary choice to be a subject. We get to talk here for a little bit about Nazis. So, in World War II, there were experiments done in the concentration camps on different people. Some of you know, or some of you may have heard Bill Seidelman, who was here talking earlier, but a little bit in the readings, there's some discussion, and this has been one of my big missions in looking at research in World War II. The people who did the research, there are sort of two kinds of researchers out there. One is very prominent, and Hollywood loves that researcher, and that would be Mengele. People love Mengele. He's a real fiend. He does terrible research. He is out on the fringe. He's kind of a crazy man who gets into a position of authority and does what he wants in the concentration camp to whoever he wants. But nobody takes him very seriously because they never use his research and no one ever discusses it, and it's not very good research. But it's easier to accept Dr. Mengele if you're trying to understand what did people think about when they did these kinds of nasty research trials on people in the camps. Harder to understand is the more mainstream scientists who actually did most of the research in the camps. But Mengele is kind of an easier figure because we can dismiss him. In Germany during World War II, if you want to see automatically what triggers mainstream scientists doing some pretty awful experiments on people, you have to look to see who sponsored the research, and pretty quickly, as soon as you see it sponsored by the Army or the Air Force, it's got mainstream researchers doing it. For example, people wanted to know if you could convert seawater to drinkable water. And that was a big goal for the military, and they spent a lot of time poisoning a whole bunch of people trying to make seawater drinkable. People wanted to know what to do at high altitude if you had to bail out or you lost pressure in your cabin in a plane, particularly since the Germans were working hard to develop jets that flew at pretty high altitude. They didn't want to lose pilots, and so they did a lot of decompression experiments, killing all kinds of subjects. They wanted to know how to get wounds healed quicker. They wanted to know how to prevent typhus and typhoid by giving shots or medicine. They wanted to know how could you best help somebody recover who had been in freezing temperatures or freezing water, the hypothermia experiments. Each one of those experiments is done by very legit scientists. They have methods, they have a hypothesis, they absolutely are doing research in a serious way. And some of it gets published. And all of us have used a little bit of it. You've probably heard me say in other contexts, everybody's used research from the Nazi experiments, because one thing they found was that the crucial step in keeping someone alive after they were exposed to very cold water was to keep their head out of water. The old way of having life vests and life preservers on boats was to have a life belt. That was what they used in the Titanic, as a matter of fact, a belt that was wrapped around your waist. What's today's life preserver look like?
It's around your neck.
The around your neck thing is what the Nazis learned by keeping your head out of water, as opposed to trying to keep the top half of your body out of water, which is much harder. And it works. What you're trying to do, if you remember back to our little discussion about permanent vegetative state, you're trying to keep the cerebellum and the inner brain out of the water. That's the key to living longer. It doesn't work forever, but it helps. So we've all seen those life preservers. The design change is everywhere, and that came out of the hypothermia experiments in the camps, in which a lot of people died. You can also tell that the Germans were serious about research when they started to substitute for subjects. They didn't like Jews or gypsies in studies where they really cared to generalize out to the military, so they often substituted political prisoners, Dutch doctor resistors, that kind of thing. They were very careful to match racial type when they thought they wanted to generalize out to the armed forces the results of what they were doing. Whereas Mengele certainly didn't care who he was experimenting on at any time. All right, so the point being that there's some pretty serious research. It delivers some results that are used. It's talked about in journals and meetings. And mainstream, very distinguished people do it. They're ultimately put on trial at the end of World War II. The Nuremberg trial has a doctor's trial and focuses in on the concentration camp experiments. It focuses in there in part because people survived and could say, I was at Dachau, and they did the hypothermia experiments there, and he killed him, and I saw it. So they had, for lawyers here, they had eyewitness accounts of who harmed somebody, as opposed to more general, vague things like somebody ordered a lot of people to be killed in that village over there, but I didn't see anything directly, which was harder to establish liability. But from the camp experiments, you can sort of say, this happened on this day, and I remember that three people froze to death that day, and he was there, and this is what he did. So partly, it wasn't just that it was the experiments, which were certainly horrific, but you could kind of tie them to the researcher in a way that could generate liability. These guys had a defense, and it's interesting that none of them said what I did was wrong. And I'm not surprised about this, although there's a whole area of interesting bioethics thinking here about is there such a thing as Nazi ethics? I think there is, although that gets some people pretty mad to hear it, but I think there is. And I'm going to tell you what I think some of the principles were. One was, it's acceptable to sacrifice a small number of people to benefit the majority. You see, that's said a lot by the research. So if we could learn a cure for typhus or develop some knowledge about how to heal wounds, this would benefit a lot of people. And it's true we had to kill people, but only a relatively small number to get a big benefit. So there's a sort of utilitarian, crude utilitarianism that comes into play in research ethics when the German researchers talked about why they did what they did. A second very common argument is that people who are prisoners have no rights. So prison research gets to become a very big deal later after World War II because people are commonly saying, if you're in prison, we can do what we want to you. You owe society because you're a prisoner, a criminal. So being in experiments, that's to be expected. Now you might say, well, why is some six-year-old a prisoner because of their race or ethnicity or something? But anyway, the prisoner argument is big. Third is national security. You have to do what is necessary to preserve the safety of the state. That means killing people who are enemies of the state anyway, then we have to do that. If those of you who followed some of the torture arguments, waterboarding and stuff, in Abu Ghraib and so on, it's not so different from that line of argument. That it's true this may be cruel or not something that scientists and doctors really would do, but when we're pushed to the limit by terrorists, we have to wave off the usual protections. And the fourth thing they said was these people are going to die anyway, so what in the hell is the difference what we do to them? They're going to get killed anyway. And that's a version of doom to die. If you're going to die, you might as well learn something before you die. So it's not like we're killing them, they're going to die anyway. They can die in our decompression experiment, they can die in a gas chamber. They're all going to die. So we're not harming anybody more than they would have been harmed anyway. So those are some of the arguments. And now you can understand why the principle of informed consent or voluntary choice to be in research looms up so big. It's because it's the answer to those claims. The argument that you can sacrifice the few to help the many is not accepted. And the principle is put in that you have to choose yourself to be in research. Even if we could learn a lot by dragging you into research or coercing you into research, we shouldn't do that. You get to choose whether you want to be in research. Or to put it another way, research is to be something you offer or give, not something that you must do. You could have an ethic in the United States now that everybody has to be in a research trial. There are a couple places, anybody name one, where to get in, you have to be in a research trial. The NIH Clinical Center in Bethesda. If you don't agree to be in research, you can't get admitted there. It's just a condition. Sometimes we say you can't be admitted to HUP unless you're willing to be a teaching subject, right? That's just part of what it means to be in a teaching hospital. You have to be available to let students learn from you. That's a version of the, you don't have a choice, you have to do it. Now, assumedly, it would be nice if we told people perhaps a little more loudly that in teaching hospitals, you have to agree to be a teaching subject. Then we do. Maybe some of them would say, I don't want to go there, then I want to go to Abington or someplace that isn't a teaching hospital, but something that being off, and they don't have a choice. They're sitting in the ER with a hole in their head. They're not really negotiating this, but the idea is still that you get to choose rather than have somebody force you or coerce you into doing it. The notion that prisoners don't have any rights, obviously you're still saying they can choose. The idea that you're going to die anyway, you still get to choose. Even if you are going to die, you can't be dragged off into research. National security doesn't get rid of the need to ask people if they want to be in research. So informed consent loomed up really large because in part it was the ethics response to the German ethical arguments. It's the back and forth of it. And I should add, you can hear the power in the German ethical arguments because people still make them in different ways today. It's not like they were completely horrible arguments. You can sort of see where people are going in different directions. So what was the impact of all this assessment of the Nazis and informed consent and the Nuremberg Code and the Helsinki Code of Ethics on research ethics in the post-war era, you know, the 50s and the 60s?
Did it initially not do very much?
So you're not supposed to ask that as a question. You're supposed to say, in my reading, I saw...
Just in general, it seemed like it didn't really infiltrate into practice. And again, I think part of it may have been this line between experimentation and research. And
some of that.
You know, whether or not the use of some of these therapies was truly experimental. And again, some of the same philosophy. People are going to die anyway, especially with cancer patients and things. So it seemed like, and there just seemed to be a lag time between recognition of what occurred there and integration into practice here.
I think that's right. Anybody follow these discussions about experiments in Guatemala that got Amy Gutman all excited? We had a report written and all that sort of thing just recently. Just follow this. These revelations that there were experiments going on in a Guatemalan prison and a Guatemalan mental asylum, giving people syphilis and then studying whether penicillin would heal them. Does this ring any bells? Anybody know what year we're in? Roughly?
70.
When?
72.
72? No, earlier. Say about 1946.
46.
I would say just about the time the Nuremberg trials were going on. I would say just about the time we were telling the Germans what they shouldn't do, we were definitely doing the same things in Guatemala. So we weren't off to a great start. We didn't get any consent from anybody in those two places, I can tell you that. They knew it. The researchers knew that they were doing something that was they couldn't do in the United States very easily, they thought. So even though we're pumping out this, you got to get the permission of the subject idea, and you can't use a few people to benefit the many, they're using a few people in a Guatemalan prison and giving them syphilis in order to benefit the many who might then get cured by penicillin if it worked. Right at the same time. Exactly. Probably to the day they're in there. And those experiments ran from 1946 to 1948, so they're going on well after the Nuremberg trial's over, and we've issued the Helsinki Code of Ethics, and we're all feeling pretty good, and we all go home. It's pretty clear that what took place with this Nuremberg trial and then the Code of Ethics that the World Medical Association developed out of it was basically aimed at Dr. Mengele, cuckoo, nutty, fringe, wacko people, and nobody thought that mainstream scientists, certainly not in America, Britain, needed that kind of code. They knew what to do and they would do the right thing. Except it's clearly false. Also going on right at the time we're having the Nuremberg trial and issuing these lofty documents is the Tuskegee study. So somebody tell me what that is.
It's been
they're studying a population of black men in Alabama who had syphilis, and then they were refusing the treatment so that they could study them naturally and rest on a natural history study.
How did the Tuskegee study start? No?
The inoculation? Are they saying it was going to be an inoculation?
Nope.
There was actually a preliminary study, wasn't there, where they had actually, it wasn't really a study, they just treated a certain number of individuals.
Started off just observing and counting who had venereal disease. That was the original study, was just to count who was sick among poor people in the South, usually men and women, somewhat oversampled men. The motive was to try and get attention to a neglected population. The Tuskegee study started off as a pretty noble study. It was just trying to say, you're not paying attention to venereal disease in these very poor African-American people, and they should get some attention or public health advice. People didn't know exactly when the study began in 1932 what the cure was, but they knew they had an infectious disease, and so kind of like with HIV, you could kind of have a counseling thing about safe sex or something. I mean, there were things to say, but nobody was saying. I mean, nobody cared what was going on for the most part in these very poor, illiterate, sharecropping blacks in Alabama and Mississippi, pretty much because of racism and partly due to the racist view that whatever diseases they had, they weren't the same as whites. So you saw both of those factors coming into play. The thing that changed this was the discovery of penicillin. So penicillin gets discovered in 1929, right? Anybody see that movie? Alexander Fleming, big experimenter, standing by the window, little bit of fungus blows in and lands on his little petri dish that he's doing a study in, and it starts to, I don't know if this really happened, but it's thanks for that movie. And he realizes that it's killing whatever was in the dish. Well, Fleming did discover penicillin and find out that it did have this antibacterial set of properties. And that was nice. And that happened in 1929 before the Tuskegee study started, but it didn't make any difference because nobody knew how to make penicillin. The person who figured out how to make penicillin was somebody who realized he knew how to brew up big batches of stuff in vats, a beer maker. Anybody know who this was? This is a little bioethics trivia. Nobody? Charles Pfizer? We had a big beer place in Brooklyn and said, hey, you want me to make a lot of bacteria in a vat? I can do that. I'm making a lot of beer in vats, so I can probably make that stuff in vats. And he was the one who figured out how to make it in bulk. That's where Pfizer came from. And he began to make enough of this stuff so that by the end of World War II, there was a lot of penicillin around. And you could give it to different people. By the way, as a side note for those of you interested in rationing, during World War II, there was some amount of penicillin around, but not much. So you could give it to people who were in the Tuskegee study because you knew they probably would be helped. You could give it to babies who got bacterial infections or sepsis because you knew it would probably help them. You could give it to troops who were injured on the battlefield and had war wounds, infections. Or you could give the little supply to soldiers who were injured in brothels. Got venereal disease. So I had to decide who to give it to. Anybody want to guess who they gave it to? Who? The soldiers wounded in the battlefield? In the brothels. That's who got it. And why? Because they could get them back to fighting faster. So the rationing principle used was get the armed forces as effective as you could, and if you were wounded, you probably going to take a long time to get better, but if you just had a bout of gonorrhea, they could give you this stuff and maybe get you back out there fighting, and that's who got it. It is sometimes said that the people in the Tuskegee study didn't get penicillin in World War II. That's true, but almost nobody got penicillin in World War II. There wasn't much of it around to give out, and they certainly weren't giving it to babies here either. Nobody got it here except soldiers they thought they could get back to fighting. I'm not saying that decision was wrong. I'm just saying. So it wasn't until they could make a lot of it that the Tuskegee study actually starts to go off the ethics rails. And it goes off the ethics rails because they want to finish the study and see what happens to people who get syphilis all the way to the time that they die, and they start to say, well, you know, these people, these men, they're all men at this point, all have syphilis. They've had a long time, so I don't even know if they're going to get better if we give them penicillin. They didn't try it. They just said, I don't know. They said, they're probably not going to take their penicillin. They're just poor black guys anyway. Would they actually take their medicine? And we could learn a lot that would benefit a lot of people if we could just take these few people in the study, it's a relatively small number who are still alive, and take them out to the finish, their death. So they continue the study, and it goes to 1972. That's the one you might have been thinking of. And a lot of people die, and they're still infectious. They did decide to offer anybody in the study a free funeral. It's the only time I know in American research where somebody got a free funeral, offered as a benefit of being a subject. But they certainly didn't give them medicine. And the subjects, however, began to ask, because they were hearing about other people who weren't in the study who were getting treatment for the term there was bad blood, meaning syphilis. And they knew friends of theirs who were getting medicine. And so they started to say, are we getting that medicine? And the researcher said, yes, you are. But they weren't. They gave them placebos or non-active substances. So, by the 1950s and 60s, way after those Nuremberg trials, way after the Helsinki Code of Ethics, they're running a study in which they're lying to the men, saying they're giving them treatment, when in fact they're still studying them, they're giving them sugar pills, they are not treating them, because they think that the value of learning about the what syphilis does is worth the final sacrifice of these guys. It's a sort of German argument in a couple of ways. They're doomed to die. We could learn a lot. You might even say national security, if we're going to fight the communist demands that we know how to treat syphilis. Sounds stretched, but people were thinking that way at the time. So they don't intervene. They do one thing, though. They make sure that everybody in the study gives consent. And since nobody in the study was able to read, all the consent forms have big X's on the bottom. So later, people said, well, you know, the men consented. But it was clear that they had not been told the truth, that they weren't given all their options, and that they couldn't really have read whatever it was that they signed. So informed consent wasn't good enough as a protection for people in research. These guys are in research. They signed a form, but it wasn't enough. They got tricked, lied to, not given all their options. That's where the idea came from of peer review and review by committees, or what we call in the United States institutional review boards, or what they call in Europe and Japan ethics committees. How many of you heard that word, institutional review board, or IRB? It's in the readings, too. So this is just a committee formed at each institution that does research. It has rules about how it has to operate, who's supposed to be on it, although they're relatively loose about membership. I think it's a minimum of 5 people, one of whom is supposed to be a non-doc, non-researcher, civilian kind of person. You can have more, but you're supposed to have at least one, a layman. And then they're supposed to do a couple of things. One is they're supposed to look at the informed consent forms and make sure they're truthful. Two, they're supposed to look at the research protocol and make sure it is reasonable in terms of risk and benefit. Somebody might be willing to sign up for a study in which they said, I don't want to get penicillin because I'm going to die to help the world or something. The institutional review board can say that's too risky or that's not acceptable. We're not going to allow that, even if you would volunteer for it. So in research ethics, unlike therapy, there is some room for the IRB or the committee to say, we're not going to let you take a risk that you might be willing to take. We think it's too risky even if you were willing to do it. So there is some room there for a kind of paternalism about what's too risky. They're also supposed to make sure that you know you're in research, and they're also supposed to make sure that the hypothesis that's being studied has a reasonable chance of getting answered by the methods used, that definition of research. So they have work to do in terms of making sure, if you will, that the science is sound and that everything's being disclosed. And that's the second protection for research subjects. Not just to get consent, but somebody's going to vet your consent so that you get all your choices, you get the right risk-benefit ratio, you know what's going on, you know your alternatives and options. And they've made an examination and say, yes, this question could be answered by the techniques you're using, and it's reasonably, the risk isn't crazy to offer this to people. So that's where IRBs come from. And by the way, without going on and on and on and on about it, in the 1950s, there were lots of experiments being done all over the place that did not meet the Nuremberg requirements of the health seeking. It wasn't just Tuskegee in Guatemala. There are kids in homes for the mentally retarded deliberately getting hepatitis so that you can study a cure. Willowbrook, there are people blowing up atomic bombs on troops to see what the effects are of radiation and the psychology of it. There's no consent. There are people, Native Americans are mining away uranium for the war effort. People are watching them to see what the health effects are. They don't tell them, but they know they're getting sick. There are plenty of these. There's experiments in the Philadelphia prisons on prisoners to study what became ultimately acne medicine. Retin-A. I don't think the prison experiments in Philly were brutal in terms of the risk they posed to the prisoners, but there were certainly some people had side effects and discomfort, but they never really explained them what the hell they were doing, and they really didn't care much about the consent very much because they were prisoners. Remember the older argument that prisoners are kind of fair game? That's what it was. And if you'd gone to researchers in the 50s and 60s and said, well, I want to study children, they would have pointed you toward the nearest orphanage or home for mentally impaired children and said, you go there, despite what the code of ethics said about the importance of consent. So we didn't really live up to our standards. It was the Tuskegee study and the creation of these IRBs that really was the big change in research ethics. It wasn't really Nuremberg or the concentration camp ethics, it was Tuskegee. Tuskegee, I think, is the most important event in changing attitudes about how to deal with subjects, because it adds a bunch of oversight to the informed consent requirement, and people weren't following the informed consent requirement anyway. It wasn't just on African-American people, it was on anybody, prisoners, orphans, people in mental homes, soldiers, people who are more vulnerable than average. Poor Hispanic women. I don't know how many of you know this, there was a great study done about full disclosure of the first birth control pills in poor women in Brownsville, Texas, Hispanic women. Turned out that it wasn't a psychological effect. The pill really did prevent conception. It came as a surprise, I think, to many in the study. They were getting told they were getting this birth control pill. Anyway, that takes us up to 72, and a couple of things happened from then on. So we have institutional review boards. They begin to proliferate all around the country, and indeed we start to export this model to the world. So pretty soon, all around the world, you've got review committees and consent forums moving, and there are all kinds of issues that are coming up, which we won't have time to go into now, but there's questions about how do you do research on children? Should you have higher standards? Can you expose them to the same risk as adults if they can't choose, if their parents or someone else has to choose for them? Anybody know what the answer is to that one about pediatric research? Can you expose them to the same risk as adults? To do research in children, you're supposed to have a lower risk-benefit threshold. For you, you could decide up to where the IRB says it's not crazy risky to take a lot of risk. For a kid, it's not supposed to be more risk than they would ordinarily encounter in their everyday life. Whatever that means. There's been plenty of screaming about that over the years, but, I mean, depends on the kid, I guess, you know. There are plenty of kids who seem to be encountering a whole lot of risk in everyday life, and then some of them just sit in front of a computer. Well, that could be risky, too. I don't know, whatever it is. Anyway, so at least more restrictive on risk. And for kids, really, they're supposed to be in research that is intended to either benefit them or people like them who have the same disease. So you really can't use kids easily just in exploratory research like in adults. I might decide to sign up for an experiment on sleep deprivation because a researcher wants to know how badly will I perform if I'm kept awake for 80 hours. That's a tough study to get done in a kid because there's no goal of trying to help kids with that research. It's just trying to understand some basic biology. That's sometimes called a challenge study or a physiological study. Those are very hard to do in children. So there are restrictions on what you can do with kids. There are also restrictions pretty soon on what you can do with embryos. There are special rules that come out on prisoners. They're still hard to use in studies, even when they want to be in studies. You know why now. It's because of his history, basically. History of abuse, that's why. It's not that prisoner X on day Y can't really choose to say, I'd like to be in this study. It's that people are just cautious about getting too much research into prisons because it hasn't been... The historical experience has been bad. It was bad for a long time. And institutional review boards are set up to deal with researchers locally. Remember I said it's local committees. That's partly because they can keep an eye on the researchers and they can say, you know, that researcher, he's got three projects going already. Even though he got funded for this fourth one, we don't think he can take it on. He's going to be overwhelmed. Or we think Miss X is a little sleazy, and maybe we're not going to really let her do this study without some extra supervision because she's been in trouble the past research that she did, so we got to watch her more. It's that kind of local review kind of idea. And most research in the 70s and 80s is getting funded by the government. They're big, for those of you who know this lingo, they're big individual researcher grants, R01s. And they are the primary mechanism for funding. And so you have local review by local committees of local researchers who are on government money. What's different about that picture today? Who's written a grant lately? Anybody reviewing proposals? Any of you involved in that?
It's more corporate money than government.
So the corporate money is at least as big, if not bigger, than federal funds, and the federal amount has been falling. So all of a sudden we have the appearance of large companies, and some small ones, sponsoring a lot of research. That started to happen in the 80s when all of a sudden you could start to see relationships with universities being encouraged by Congress to develop new drugs. That's called the Bayh-Dole Act, for those of you who ever want to wander off in that direction. So there was incentives to go partner between industry and medical schools and academic medical centers. It's partly because the NIH budget didn't grow that fast, and pharmaceutical companies need more research done, so they started to pay for it and get it done. It's partly because we had more advances during this period, understanding all kinds of genetics and different areas of science, so research started to grow faster. All of that's going on. What else is different? So that's one, corporate sponsorship. How many people today run a study at one place by one investigator?
Not many.
Not many. They're usually multi-site studies, right? And oftentimes international. You might have a study site in four or five locations to recruit people, get it done faster, or maybe it's a relatively rare disease, so you're trying to look for people who have the thing you're trying to study in different places. That notion of one researcher at one place studying people locally and getting reviewed locally has gotten replaced by international research, multi-site research, many people collaborating together, bigger numbers of subjects. So very different today than it was 30 years ago in terms of how the research is getting done. Multi-site research is, you know, sort of the routine now. I won't say it's the only thing, but it's very, very common, international, crossing boundaries, certainly crossing state lines. So the researcher all of a sudden is stuck with a weird question. Which IRB am I supposed to be responsible to? And that old notion of the local IRB would know the researcher and kind of be able to keep an eye on them, that's long gone. If I sent in an IRB today, and somebody from Duke writes in and says, we're doing an HIV study, one of the subjects died, but we don't think it has anything to do with the drug that we're testing. That's a pretty common report. I've seen a lot of those. What am I to make of that? What would you make of it?
Is it only one person? Just that one person?
That one person died. And Mr. Duke says it is not related to the drug.
Isn't there a committee that oversees
You could be on that committee too and get the same report.
Or look at the adverse events associated with that study.
You might take a look at all of them and say, well, there don't seem to be any other deaths. Let's make that up. So the point is, do you trust Mr. Duke, who just told you this? Well, you might trust him if you knew who he was, but the chances are you have no idea who this guy is. You don't know whether you should trust what he says or not. Maybe he's covering up. Maybe he's lying. Are you going to fly down to Duke and find out? Very unlikely. You'd call up the Duke IRB and say, who is this guy and what's he doing? But that's even a bigger step than most IRBs tend to take. They tend to say, okay, we'll trust Mr. X. Remember I told you about research integrity. If he says it's not connected, it's not connected. So we now have reports coming in from 20 sites around the world saying, yeah, we got this problem, we got that problem, but in our view locally, our drug or device or vaccine isn't the cause. And you're kind of sitting there in Philly saying, gee, I hope they're right. Because I'm not going to track down all 20 places and see what's going on. Which is different than in the early days when if you just had one researcher, you could actually get him in the lunchroom and say, what is going on with that, whatever you're doing? Why did that guy die? You tell me that it wasn't related to the drug, and maybe I'll trust you because I know you, so I believe you. So a very different world has emerged in which the older system, which was built on local review, is starting to get creaky relative to national and international scope of research with a lot of investigators, oftentimes funded by private money, not government money. So that certainly has presented the problem of conflict of interest. If my school Penn says we need to get money in the dermatology department because we're not getting the same kind of grant support we used to, and there's a company that's offering us money, if we run a study of their latest baldness treatment. So we decide, well, it may not be the most important medical problem, but they are paying, and if we take this on, we can get money into the department, and that will help us pay for our students and fellows and other things that we want to pay for. So we'll do this, we'll accept the money for this study, even though, notice I said it may not be our research priority, but it's what the company wants to get done. They need a trial to go to the FDA to get their drug approved. So all of a sudden, when private money appears, it may start to distort what it is that the academic center studied. I may not think that baldness is biggest challenge in life, but that's where the money is, so I'm going to do a few of those. Even if it is, and they give me the money to do it, now they're starting to say, well, here's how we want you to run this study. Use this amount of the drug and use this amount of people. And you start to say, but I'm not sure that's the right way to study this, or that's more likely to hide any adverse events or problems. You're not getting a big enough sample, you're not following them long enough, and they say, no, take it or leave it. Here's the study design. And that's what I mean about conflict of interest. both in the selection of the problem or in saying, I got to negotiate the methods with somebody who may not have every incentive to want to show the worst part of this drug. It can get sticky. And it can get a little worse because let's say this volumous treatment is one that happened to get invented by a faculty member at the University of Pennsylvania. So he's all gung-ho to get it studied because he's going to make money if the drug sells. And by the way, so won't the University of Pennsylvania because they take a cut. So now we have some interesting conflicts of a very different sort. Now I'm going to make money if I'm the researcher, not just from getting paid to do research, but if the thing works. And my school is going to get money, which maybe they'll use to promote me because they like seeing people bring money to the school. So conflict of interest can arise in all kinds of different ways around finances, financial considerations. The way we manage that right now is to ask for disclosure. You have an ownership interest in the product, you must tell the subject, and you must tell the IRB. If you have any kind of financial conflict more than trivial, even if your family members do, it has to be disclosed and probably put up on a website so anybody could see who wanted to what your financial conflict of interest is. Some places take it a little further and say, if you own something, try not to be involved in studying it. The don't study what you own principle is used, although, obviously in some areas, if you're the first person to invent something, there may be nobody else to study it but you because no one else knows what it is, so, or they're not set up to do it. So you can't always do that. Some places try. If it's the baldness treatment, and I have a patent on the thing, and 10 other schools could run the exact same baldness treatment to see if it grows hair, that might be one I should say, well, we don't do it here. You do it somewhere else, and then the researcher and the school pen will get the money, but we're not going to study it. We shouldn't study what we have a direct interest in. We should farm that one out. But if I've got some embryonic stem cell thing that I think is a unique way to make stem cells, like will be announced tomorrow in Nature, and I decide that I have a patent on it and I want to get it done here, but I want to study whether I can use stem cells to fix something, well, I may not want to farm it out because I'm not going to tell anybody else what my little tricks are right yet. Until it's proven to work, then I'm not so eager to say, yeah, you guys at Duke, you study, and here's how it works, and, you know, steal my idea. So that's where the conflict of interest things get very tough to manage, very difficult. Transparency and trying not to study what you own may not be enough. I can tell you pretty simply, if you want to find an area that needs more thinking and more contribution, it's managing conflict of interest. We don't have it solved particularly well. It's a mess. And it drives researchers nuts because on the one hand, we're saying, please invent things, please bring money to the school, please make sure that you patent the license and get equity and all kinds of wonderful things that you can invent here, but make sure you don't have any conflicts.
Well, it even gets down to speakers, like speaking about sure. something, too, because the people that have the most experience working with new treatments mm-hmm. are limited.
Or being on a committee,
you know,
to approve something.
Right.
So I say, well, I want to decide whether we should approve this new stent that secretes drugs as part of what it's doing in the heart. So let me put a panel together to advise the FDA on whether they think this stent is any good. It turns out that every single cardiologist that I could ask is working for one of the companies that makes the stents. So who should I put together as a panel? 3 veterinarians and an ethicist? I mean, everybody who knows something about it is working with the stent companies. And that often turns out to be true in looking for experts. The drug companies want those experts working with them. The people making the stents want to work with them. There's a sort of, you know, we want to get this technology moving. We can each benefit. It's all good. There's not much out there in terms of people who are independently objective. Or by the time you find that independently objective cardiologist, he's basically working at Frank's Hospital in Bojangles somewhere. He's not the world's best expert, and the rest of the people who are going to get a panel decision look at this guy and say, I wouldn't invite this guy to my house for a dinner, much less have him on a panel reviewing my work. This is crazy. He's not qualified. So that's where you get into these other fights. But on the research side, conflict of interest, we are trying to acknowledge it's a problem, and it can put subjects at risk if they don't know that the investigator has a stake, might be underplaying the risks of being in the research, might be hyping the advantage of being in the research. That's what conflict of interest, the problem for the subject is trying to make sure that you get a square deal of information and deciding whether you're going to do this or not. All right, a couple of other little facts, and then I can give you the cases, and you can wrestle with these a little bit. Not everybody can get into research. We were talking about expanding research and having more of it done in different countries and different centers, and it's growing and more private money comes in, but some studies may only have room for, say, 20 or 30 people in them, partly for reasons as basic as when a new company starts and they're trying a new drug, they may not make enough to get to more than 20 or 30 people. It may be very expensive to make whatever it is they're trying to study. They don't have a factory. They're a little startup company. They brew up about as much as they can, and that's all they've got. So there's a new study for something like end-stage lung cancer. And nothing works for that, and you hear that it's out there, but they say, you know, there's only going to be room for 30 people in this study. Because that's all the drug we've got. And furthermore, we're a little company. We can't really afford that much research. So even if we had more drug, we also want to study this in 30 people, and then we'll move on to a bigger study, if it's safe, so that we can attract in more money. But right now, we don't want to do more than 30 people. That's all we need to do to move this thing along. So there are situations in which people want to get into studies where there may not be slots or room for them. There are also situations in which somebody's studying a drug that's already been approved for one reason, but has now caught somebody's eye for a different reason. And they may be using it so-called off-label. Drugs get approved for certain indications and purposes from the research. But I may see this pill works in people over 18 to help them sleep at night, and now I want to test it in people who are 14. But I didn't ever study anybody who's 14. I can organize a study, or I can just say, you know what, this is an approved drug, I'm going to start giving it to 14-year-olds, and that's the difference between innovation and research. But let's say I do want to do a study of 14-year-old to 18-year-old kids just to see, is this antidepressant or sleep medication, whatever it is, helpful. I can try to organize that study, but it may be that the docs down the road are just giving it out off-label. So who's going to come into my study if they can get it off-label down the road with very little hassle? So there's competition sometimes to recruit subjects. There's basic competition. University of Pennsylvania has all kinds of trials and studies going on for, let's say, breast cancer. I'm an oncologist out in the community, and I use the standard treatments for breast cancer. I really don't want all my patients going into studies at the University of Pennsylvania. For what reason?
Works. You don't know if this
I don't know if it works. They might get poor outcomes. What else is on my mind? Since I like eating. I don't want them all referred up to Penn. Who's going to be seeing, what patients am I going to be seeing in Toms River if every one of them runs off to Penn to get in these studies? So there's tension between, do I refer them? Do I let them know there are these studies? Or do I say, you know, what I do is I give the standard of treatment, I give standard care, and that's how I make my living. I don't make my living by saying, ooh, whenever you're really sick, why don't you go somewhere else? If I'm special. So I have a tension between referring people to studies and keeping them and trying to treat them and use what I know to be best. And I might say to myself, I know those studies. Nobody ever gets any benefit out of them anyway. Didn't Art Kaplan say it's very rare to get real benefit out of studies? So I'm not going to send them off to get experimented on. I'll just keep them here and keep treating them. The stuff I have isn't that great, but it's better than getting experimented on to no purpose. So, I mean, that's the kind of mental gymnastics that you might hear about referring people to research. I want to do research. Now, another thing that I need to keep in my mind, how many of you have done any research? When you pick subjects, what sorts of things are you thinking about if you want to be able to interpret the results of your research when you pick subjects?
If they're going to stay in the study through the end of it.
Compliance. Is this a compliant group? I really don't like doing research on homeless people. They're hard to find, they're back, they don't wander away. I may say that about people with drug problems. Maybe I'm not going to sample them too much, even though this drug might be something that those people might use too, but they're not the easiest people to keep tabs on. What else?
Demographics or general for the generalizability of the...
Mm-hmm. So you're sort of thinking, I can study this in one segment of society, but maybe I need to sample broadly because the results might differ if I had different ages or different groups.
You look at the actual health of the individuals that you choose for your study because you'll tend to pick someone who's going to have less problems further on so that your study will look better.
Yeah, that's the one I'm really looking for. So partly you're looking at your subjects and you're thinking, if they're half dead and they all die during this study, then my drug is going to look horrible because they're all going to be dead taking this drug. Maybe I could take at least the healthier ones and see, and at least I'd have to deal with their underlying illnesses causing them problems. And to put that in a little happier light, I can also say to myself, if they do have problems, how am I going to know if they're very sick? They'll get masked or disguised if they're already sick. It's hard to tell whether, that's why I gave you that thing, when the guy from Duke writes and says, we don't think the drug killed him, we think his HIV killed him. That could be true, but it's hard to tell. Whereas if you had somebody who was just early stage HIV, then if they die, you're probably thinking it's probably my drug that's got a problem as opposed to the disease. So taking sicker and frailer people can be held against your drug, or it makes it hard to interpret the results. In research terms, you need a clean baseline. You're going to see whether something's bad or good. And so that drives subject selection. The process by which drugs get approved in most vaccines goes like this. Start in animals, if you can. Sometimes there's no real animal model of a disease, but even there you're supposed to dose the animals just to see how toxic your drug or vaccine is. And in fact, the requirement is, in the U.S., that you have to give them a dose big enough to see when half the animals die. So from an animal rights perspective, it's built in to animal research that you're going to kill half the animals, whether they're mice or primates or whatever they are, which tends to push people to use mice rather than primates because it's hard to go around publicly and say, I just killed half of the chimps or baboons here. So mice and rats tend to die in big numbers to establish what is the toxic dose that kills half of them. And that sort of sets your first safety perimeter about how much drug you could think about using. You may also do animals and see some positive responses and things or other issues come up. So you're studying the animals not just to see how much they can take of it, but also whether they seem to be responding. And that's what I meant when I said not every disease has an animal model, but if you have one, you're trying to study the animals to see if they respond. Remember, even if they do respond, it doesn't mean that humans will. That's why I made that joke before, that it's good to be a mouse with cancer. You can get a lot of shrinking tumors in mice for some reason that just don't do it in people. Then you move up to people. What's the next step for people? Anybody know what we do next?
You do trials with healthy individuals.
And what's the goal of those?
It's just to make sure your drug's not killed.
Safety. Pure safety. Purely a safety study. So a small number of people are selected. They oftentimes are healthy, but they can be people with the disease too if it's a really... If it's a drug targeted to treat, let's say, lung cancer, you're not going to start with just healthy volunteers. You're probably going to start with 20 early-stage lung cancer patients because you're afraid that you, if you were worried that you would give somebody a disease or might accelerate something that hadn't been detected, you're a little careful about who it is that goes first in trials. But the point of phase one or first-stage trials is to show safety. You're guided a little bit by the animal data of where to start. But remember, what you can do with a mouse in terms of giving a drug isn't necessarily what you can do with a person. A mouse, you may stick the drug into their liver through a tube. It may not turn out to be very practical to do that with people. So you may have to give it to them in a pill, or give it to them IV, or give it to them in a suppository, or who knows what, inhale it. But the route of administration is also part of what you're looking at when you're doing safety. Second step is to study it now and see what doses you can go up to without getting any side effects. So you had this animal thing that said that kills half of them. You've done a little study that says I've given it to people in some modest amount and nothing bad happened. Now I'm going to give it to people a little more amount, but not quite to where I had the dead mice, but somewhere in between. And that's going to tell me how much of this they can take or tolerate. That's phase two. Phase three is, now I'm going to study it for efficacy. And then a bigger group still, I'm going to see if I give them this amount of dose over a longer period of time, anything good happen. And phase four is, got approval from the FDA, it's out in the world like Vioxx, but I'm still going to keep an eye out to see if I'm getting reports of side effects. Very small numbers in phase one, phase two, a little bit bigger in phase three, but all those considerations we talked about of healthier subjects, whether you want to sample people of every age or just a range, you're going to do kids, you're going to do pregnant women or not, those are all being kicked around at the phase three level, gay men, no gay men, that kind of thing. And then at phase four, it's out in the world, and so everybody who might get it is going to get it. And there may be things that you didn't even see at this phase three stage because now you're out giving it to everybody. Plus, phase three, it's carefully controlled. I'm watching them. I know they're taking their medicine the way they're supposed to. Phase four in the world, they're taking ginkgo biloba. They take the pill when they feel like it. They take the pill when they feel sick, but as soon as they feel better, they don't take it anymore. They figure one pill was good, four must be better, 20 is really good. You have all kinds of interesting compliance issues in what people do out in the real world with their medicine. So, you may still pick up, as Vioxx did, issues about heart attacks or problems in old people. You didn't have enough old people in the phase three studies to really see it. But when you opened it up to lots of old people in the last step, once it got approved, all of a sudden you're starting to get enough old people to pick up a signal that there's a problem. Animals, phase one, two, three, four. There are people still who are very sick who are saying, you know what? That process you just told me about, animals, phase one, two, three, four, usually takes about 7 years. I don't have 7 years. I might not even have 7 months. What am I supposed to do if you're studying the next best breast cancer, lung cancer, Parkinsonism medicine, and I would like to have it? Or my kid has now been institutionalized for the fifth time in a row for drug abuse, and you're studying a cocaine vaccine, something that might prevent them from getting high, and I don't think he's going to make it to a sixth hospitalization because he's going to kill himself.
They can make an exception.
So the issue becomes, should we make any exceptions? Do we have any waivers? Or to put it another way, given the way you asked that question, do you have any compassion? You hard heart. So are we going to ever let anybody in to a study who technically doesn't even fit the study description because they're going to be dead by the time this thing is over? They won't care. We might say, we're only going to study it right now on people 18 to 40 who are relatively healthy, and we'll kind of see the side effects in them, and we don't want to make the drug come out too bad, so we don't want any 80-year-olds in here because the chances of a lot of them dying are pretty high anyway, so we're not going to hold that against the drug, so we're going to really try and control this thing in phase three. And I would like to get into this study of the next HIV drug because I'm, like, really sick. And I've tried everything and it didn't help me. So here comes your case. You know what the principles are. You know who's reviewing things. You know we're managing conflict of interest and a number of others. Got a group over here, a group here, and a group here. We've got three chairs. We're going to do the talking for the groups, but you can certainly correct them and yell at them just like they do in an IRB. I didn't say that. you left that. I have a child. I'm the person who has a child. And my child is dying of a nasty brain tumor. And there is a company, and you're the IRB, watching this study that is doing research on an anti-cancer drug for brain tumors. Not exactly like the one my child has, but close. In other words, slightly genetically different, but it's close to the one that my child has. We've tried all the standard treatments for this, radiation, chemo, nothing's happening. The doctors tell me that he only has a few months to live. Nobody survives this. Everybody dies, we know that. And I really would like him to get into this trial that you are running. Your trial is actually at phase one. You're just trying to study safety. You do have people who are getting the drug right now. They're all adults. It's a trial for adults. There's no pediatric use. But I saw, or heard, somehow found out that you have this study at your place and one other place. And I would like my kid to get this drug. I know that it worked in animals, because I read about that online. And so I know that there were some shrinkage of brain tumors in mice, so that makes me even more interested in getting it. So I want to appeal to you as the IRB to let my child get this drug. How that happens, I don't really care, but it's the only last resort I've got. So what your job is the IRB, is to give me an answer. And I'll make it fun, as sometimes happens at IRBs, you can give it to me directly, as the dad, like face-to-face-ish. I might mention a couple other things. I'm a little ornery. I'm perfectly willing to go to the newspapers if you don't give me what I want. And you're going to look really bad if there's a headline that says, you're sponsoring a study, and my kid's dying, and you're not giving that kid any chance. But I have nice pictures of my kid, too. He's pretty damn cute. Just something to think about. Not that I'm threatening you or anything, but something to think about. I know I could write to Art Kappa. He'd help me. He's always looking for that weak and afflicted type. All right, so think about that. You can have like 10 minutes to talk about it, and then we'll sort of hear from each three of you.
So the first thing is, do we have it?
Yeah. I mean, so far away. Not for the kids, not for the parents.
So you could I mean, if you make your best educated guess, and then you have some confidence in the person, and they are still looking at adults.
Just in the initial phase one.
Right. You don't agree with me, I know, but I just think it's not in the law, like, it's not going to be, it's not going to get it.
And it could be detrimental to the study itself.
And I thought too, in regards to the sponsor, like the hospital or university that's sponsoring the project, it might be so risky that, you know, it may not be a benefit to them to let him in the study because he's doing it for everyone else.
There's some clinical trials where you've been on treatments before are excluded from being on a trial because you have cancer. There might be some other kind of interaction. So it's like if you've had certain kinds of chemotherapy, you can take this clinical trial because it would compromise the.
Outside of the trial, or
because if you're not with the child, aren't they bad? And so, that's how you're allowed to get out of the drug house. And maybe you are, because you're what we're going to.
Obviously, we would know since we were using the class pads.
We were doing something that's eccentric anyway.
I think
it's not that.
So I think that necessarily is what anybody. The whole thing about the. You said it was an IND.
Freezer often.
Okay, two more minutes.
When you slight the paper more than the other.
Just to put my name down. You guys have to write the copy of
that. Should be compromised. I need to replace it.
All right, you guys all ready? Swing back around. Now you know I'm going to go here first. So we basically are going to get three committee reports, and I don't really care if there's overlap. That's okay. I can say so anyway, but we'll start there.
So unanimously.
Sorry, I didn't get here first.
Robin.
Robin.
Our committee decided not to give the drug to the child. First of all, the doctor, in reference to the drug is geared towards adults, and there's no pediatric investigator to alter the information to gear it towards a child. Plus, we thought too, like there needs to be an IND submitted to the FDA.
That's just a special request to the FDA to exempt this.
Sorry. to get off-label use, which could take time, and if the child only has a few months, it may not happen that quickly. We also thought about, in reference to the sponsor or, you know, hospital or organization, they might not approve because, you know, it could be dangerous and they might be held liable. In reference to the person dying and not having the proper approvals. We thought cost benefit. There may not be a positive result from the cost benefit from letting him participate. We wanted to know a little bit more about the parents' history of consent in reference to their child's treatment in the past.
Very aggressive.
And then someone said in reference to like having a slippery slope effect where we may let the child in and other people may want to participate, which could may cause issues or cause issues with the results of the study. This wasn't the same type of disease. It was slightly different. So, you know, basically it's a whole new ball game because it's not the exact type of, you know, genetic.
So slightly different to a parent may not be slightly different from the point of view of the science.
Right. In reference to dosage, we wouldn't know in reference to the child, which lends back to the pediatric person being involved mm-hmm. in the study from the beginning.
And just so you will follow that, so children are little, tiny, adults big. How much you give is not necessarily just a proportion of weight. Somebody once dosed an elephant proportionately with LSD to what they gave to people and produced a very dead elephant. It's a famous experiment. Look it up. Google it. LSD and elephant. It's a little lesson in dosing there.
That's pretty much it.
Okay. That's good. Not bad. What can we do to handle this liability worry, which is there? Anything come to mind about that that you could ask me?
Would informed consent cover that?
Might. I could certainly say I consent.
We could ask you to sign some kind of waiver.
Right. So I might waive off any... Now, whether I really meant it and could be held to it and how well it would hold up, but I could at least say I release you from any liability. You might take that step if that was something that was worrying you.
Even
and companies sometimes do.
The language in a lot of informed consent forms now almost incorporates that as well. That mm-hmm. you know, in terms of actual, you know, like liability, in terms, you know, recognizing that by giving informed consent, you're, you know, recognizing that.
I would say that, too much for my taste, informed consent forms tend to be liability protectors, so that language leans that way hard. On the other hand, in reality, whether you still wouldn't sue or still couldn't make a suit, even if you'd signed an informed consent form, particularly if it was technical and complex, not so clear. So one other thing, I'm just going to jump ahead, I don't mean to step on your other presentations, but I want to make sure we say this is, if I'm going to get an informed consent from a pretty desperate parent, I might want to quiz that subject and record it so I made sure that I could say, you not only signed it, but here's what you understood, that I can show that you answered these questions. Even that isn't a gold standard, but it's better. It's better. Sorry, what's your first
name? Nicole.
Nicole.
We actually voted in favor of giving the drug to
you. Well, I'll go to you.
Yeah.
And the reason I mentioned that right away is, that's called IRB shopping.
Oh. So we're a little more compassionate than this group. We were concerned, though, about some similar things. We were concerned about the idea of there being a higher safety threshold for children. We don't know a lot about the dosing yet. We don't know about the toxicity or the safety of this drug. So we're definitely concerned about that. And we're also concerned about blurring the lines between therapy and research. You know, we don't want to act as this kid's doctor, and we don't want to try to make a determination as to how effective this drug is going to be in this kid, because it's not what our study's about. Our study's about this one population of adults that we're studying right now.
And you're studying them for
just for safety.
Purely right safety. So you don't have much to say about benefit right at
so
all right
we
now.
We really don't have anything to say about that. But barring those things that we were concerned about, and also, you know, without more information on how toxic the drug is and how much time the kid has to live and how what his quality of life is like, we still kind of went on a little bit of a doom to die principle. You know, if the kid is going to die anyway, and we've tried everything, all the radiations and therapies and chemotherapies that are available, you know, and if there's a slight chance that this is going to do the kid some good, then we would like to grant it. We think in terms of informed consent, you know, it's going to be difficult to get full informed consent from you because you won't be fully informed because you don't really know that much about the drug. So we would try to... we would try to form our informed consent that you would sign to be, you know, fully inclusive of all the possible risks. It would probably have to say something like, your kid could die as soon as they take this drug. We don't know. But if you were informed fully of that possibility and you signed off on that, then we would.
By the way, how much of the drug are you going to give me?
Right. Right. We did talk about that. I guess
some could probably find a pediatric consultant right of some nature to give, and a pharmacologist or some pharmacokinetics, and probably come up with something that was sound. Given that this is a safety trial, they're at the minimum dose for adults mm-hmm anyway, so extrapolating that dose is probably less risk to the kid.
So you would have to be guided by a safety dose?
Yeah, we'd be guided by the safety dose that they're using, which may affect efficacy.
The other thing was you didn't actually give us the age, and I mean when you say child,
little kid here.
You know, we're presuming it's a young child, yeah, and then the metabolism is going to be entirely different.
On this is a real world case. It's a, I think this kid was 2, maybe 1.
So
little kid,
which makes that part of it a lot more difficult.
Yeah. You didn't mention yet. What if I don't have a lot of this drug?
Oh, we didn't think of that.
So I need to finish the safety study, and now I'm going to call you up and tell you I'm the chief medical officer for startup company of tomorrow, and if you give this kid some of this drug, you're going to set us back at least a couple of months in finishing up the safety study, which you could do. I'm just telling you the investors won't like it.
Yeah, I mean, that would make me concerned. I think that, the, you know, we were kind of operating on a principle that... throwing one drug at a kid in the possibility that it would help them was going to be great and a great thing to do as long as it really didn't affect the research at all. But if it does start to affect the research, I would be more concerned about, again, blurring the lines, opening the floodgates to get how many more kids who are going to come in, yeah, and ask for this.
And just as long as you're being compassionate, let me also ask, do you expect me to pay for this? Do I have to pay?
I mean, I wouldn't make you pay, but I would
make it. You're in the IRB, so you don't have to, but from the company point of view, yeah, if I made a little bit of this drug and it was pretty expensive to make...
From the IRB standpoint, though, aren't we just, we're just sort of getting out of the way. We're saying we don't see anything done, yeah, in this, so if mm-hmm you want to, go ahead. If mm-hmm not,
you can't make me right give it as a company. But I could also say, which didn't come up yet, what if my kid responds a little bit? Can I keep getting it for a while?
Right, and obviously...
Because I doubt you're going to rescue me. That would be probably one of the great experiments of our day. If you actually turned around this end-stage brain tumor and rescued me instantly, I think that was pretty impressive. I won't publish that, though.
But again, would that be in the realm of the consideration of the IRB? I mean, again, is the IRB...
Well, you might want to say if we're going to give an exemption in terms of the research, then what's the end point to which we're going to allow you to go? I have an expectation. If you say yes, then I'm getting the ride as long as I need to. You may need to remind the company about that. They could set a limit, too.
But what if the child improves? Wouldn't that be beneficial for the company? Like...
Could be, but as a parent, finding out that the tumor shrunk a little and the kid lived another month is not going to make me stop asking for more.
Yeah, but the company could pay for it because they see something positive happening. You know,
yes, and the FDA still wants a safety study finished.
Yeah,
when you just sucked up all my drug into this one little miracle that you're running around touting all day long.
But then you need adults.
And I need adults.
Yeah, but you can.
I haven't even applied for a PET.
But you could then extend the study to that disease because.
I can. It'll take me a few. Take me about another year to get the paperwork ready. And remember what I told you about PET's research and the risk-benefit ratio.
But
it'd be more demanding of me.
But that's a precedent. There's something to go on
there. Yeah, yeah, true. But if I don't want to be compassionate, I want to be hard-nosed like you guys, I might say the best thing to do is still push it through for its approved indication, not a slightly off-cancer use, and then get that approved, and that'll still benefit more people in the longer run who have adult forms of this that really is this cancer than trying to get tangled up. Now, again, it's not totally the IRB's issue, you guys are right to say.
I was going to say, from a practical point of view, a parent generally wouldn't go directly to an IRB.
No, the request has come up.
A parent would go through an investigator or an intermediary physician or something like that.
This just landed on your desk because I'm mapping my doctor, thank you.
And I'll be honest with you, I guess I would expect that there would almost be the plan put in place by the investigator with the family. Like, how are we going to propose this to the IRB, because I think
maybe not, they could just be begging.
Well, without that, though, I think the IRB could really be, the IRB would actually have to have a plan in terms of what, do you plan to give this once, do you plan to, how do you plan to do this?
We would hope, but
at
not
least,
always.
At least, to be honest, our IRB would probably say, okay, how are you, we're not just going to, say, okay, we're going to give this once. I guess I would presume it's not really the IRB's venue to formulate the plan for how it's going to be done. The question is, would it be done?
I'm just a little drug company. I don't have all day to develop these plans.
So
I'm running out of money, and if you want me to throw a little drug at this kid, you tell me. I don't even have a human subjects person here. I've got me and three knuckleheads in a lab and some investment guy that keeps calling me up all day long saying, where's the adult approval? And I don't care how many dead children there are. That's what the message is. So, yes, this is all nice, but I need the drug. The doc's all over my back. You okay with this? We're going to do a one-time throw. And it isn't the same cancer, but I don't know. And I'm getting heat. He's saying he's going to get me in the media. It's not where I want to be.
So we said a lot of the same things as both groups because we talked about both sides and had a hard time coming to a decision. But I think ultimately we worked under the premise that the role of the IRB is to protect the subjects enrolled in the study and also protect the validity and the generalizability of those results. And so the big points that we came up against that made us decide ultimately that we couldn't give the kid the drug were that the information that you would gain from giving the drug offhand to one child wouldn't actually further the knowledge that you're getting from the study because it doesn't contribute at all to the adult study and it's not a fully structured pediatric study. So it's just sort of a shot in the dark. And then also we talked about how we don't know the nitty-gritty of this, but presumably you'd have to enroll them in the trial since it's not FDA approved yet at phase one.
You probably don't have to technically enroll them in the trial, but I will tell you this, whatever happens to the kid will be looked at relative to thoughts about the drug.
So then it could negatively affect the results of the trial, and that could hurt a lot of people if this is actually useful in adults.
This kid dies on this drug, or if this kid dies because the child is probably going to die, I'm going to have a lot of splaining to do.
Yeah. And then just the same thing that we felt like giving the drug would be blurring that line between therapy and research and that the role of research, it shouldn't really be motivated by beneficence to a specific person, but more so to a general patient population. And then there were just a lot of issues that we thought that there were a lot more issues in the study that could hurt the kid rather than help them, like that the dosage is totally unknown. That you can't really give informed consent at this stage of the trial, especially when he doesn't even have the same.
I don't want to give informed consent, I just want to save my kid.
Yeah.
You can do that in class. I got a dying kid.
Yeah. Anybody?
All right, I'll suspend that. These are good, very good. Managing conflict of interest might need to be a little more transparent about the connection between the investigator. Is there a tie? Does this investigator have a stake in the drug? We didn't get over to any sort of incestuousness about that. I didn't say whether the IRB was where the investigator was who's doing the trial or not. So I want to watch that a little bit too. Might there have been a conflict? In the real world, this case happened not too long ago. The decision was made by the company not to give the drug, partly due to cost, partly due to wanting to finish the adult trial, partly because they didn't think the cancer, by being different, was anything they were comfortable with. The parent went to every press place and politician they could find and screamed, and the politicians all said, give this child the drug. There were Wall Street Journal stories that said, give this kid the drug. They did not give this kid the drug. Kid died. At one point, the person, dad, said, I am rich enough to buy your company and give my kid the drug, which didn't happen, but it was floated. So it was a noisy, pretty empowered parent. And there still is discussion in Congress today about what to do about compassionate use and whether the system of INDs or anything else is too narrow, whether it's just not fair to the dying and the terminally ill to block access in the name of trying to get answers for the general good, which is a flip of the sacrifice of the few to help the many kind of an argument. So it remains a somewhat unsettled area. But in this case, they did not. The company, as much for business reasons as any other reasons, did not decide. I can help with their jobs.
But wasn't that the company's decision?
Yes.
As an IRB, can't they say...
Everybody else, regulators all said do it, IRB said okay.
Right, so my slightly dissenting opinion would be like, as an IRB member, I would say, you can do this, you don't have to, can't manage
it. And it's pretty easy to say, you can.
Yeah.
But the FDA was undermining, saying, and if that kid dies, it will be held against your drug.
Right.
And the company was sort of like, oh, this kid's going to die for sure. We're not giving this drug. So that was the harder decision for them.
That was more of an ethical question for the CEO.
Yes, but it was also easy for the IRBs to be compassionate because it was sort of a... the loser. And the same for the FDA and politicians and everybody else, which is part of what I wanted you to see. It's kind of, of course we care, but if you're really trying to push this drug through, it may not be the most compassionate thing to do to take the green light.
Just a quick question. So the IRBs aren't just limited to considering ethics around a research application, but also about the ethical application of a given potential intervention therapeutically.
No, their charge is really to consider the risk-benefit to the compassionate use request, to consider the degree to which the person's informed and really understands the choices, not really to think so much about the social fallout of the decision, or research per se. So it's very much focused on the subject of their proxy decision-maker in this case. And that may or may not be good policy, too, but at the end of the day, the long-term fallout is not really on the IRB's mandate. It does come up in discussions a little bit, just as it kind of does here, but it's not really their charge. Our policy, government-wise, legally-wise, is to let the chips fall out and get settled elsewhere, not in that little research space right there, you know, trying to project ahead. Okay, that was good. Thank you. Don't forget to Google up LSD and LSD.
Can I?